Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome to What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights with me, your host, Katie Kiefer. And today we're going to be talking about shellfish aquaculture with my main man, Bob Rowe. Bob was the president of Moonstone Oysters in Narragansett, Rhode Island. And for those of you who listen regularly, you know I'm a shameless and tireless promoter of all things New England and particularly Rhode Island. He was there at Moonstone for 26 years. He has a PhD in biological oceanography and is an adjunct faculty member at the University of Rhode Island's Department of Fisheries and Aquaculture. He served as the East Coast Shellfish Growers Association president for 5 years before taking the executive director's seat, which he now fills. Bob established the East Coast Shellfish Research Institute and has been successful in attracting several substantial federal research grants to address critical industry research priorities. We'll find out what those are. He is an active member of the National Fisheries Institute and is a passionate industry advocate. I can tell you that for sure because Bob was my main man in a recently published story that I produced for Food Arts Magazine about shellfish aquaculture on both the East and West Coasts. And I learned more from Bob than I did from all of the other interviews that I conducted together. So, Bob, welcome to the show, and thanks so much for giving me some time today on Father's Day. Happy Father's Day.
Oh, well, thank you, Katie. I'm excited to be on.
That's great. So, tell us a little bit about East Coast Shellfish Growers Association, and then we'll follow up with more pithy questions about the future of shellfish aquaculture and what's going on right now.
Sure. So, I represent about 1,000 small farms from Maine to Florida. With the emphasis on the word small, there's really only about a dozen farms that have more than 10 employees, so we really are dominated by mom and pops up and down the coast. It's about 60% clams and 40% oysters. Huge variability up and down the coast in terms of which states are doing it and which states are sort of watching. But it's a great industry to be an advocate for, and there's really no downside. I mean,
it's hard to say anything bad about it. Yeah,
it's a sustainable seafood. Tastes great, nutritious, and delicious. And it's great green jobs. It's a growing industry, and it's just I'm very passionate about being able to support it because there's really no downside.
Absolutely. So just in the last, I would say, 10 or 15 years, you can correct me, of course. It seems to me like the shellfish aquaculture industry has really blown up. What do you think is the cause of that?
Yeah, we're enjoying a really nice growth, pretty steady growth at about 10% year over year. Even in the challenging years of the recession, we were seeing this kind of growth. And it's not even up and down the coast, but in certain places like in Rhode Island and Massachusetts and Maine and Virginia, we've been seeing, astounding 20% year growth. So it's really, it's neat to see. And if I had to guess why that is, I'd say that we're, gradually recovering from a very old perception that shellfish are not safe to eat. And this, goes back to the early 1900s, really before we had figured out what causes illness. And we did some pretty unsafe things with our food back then. And, we thought we got sick from bad air. Well, it was really the bad oysters. And when they finally figured out what was causing these massive epidemics of cholera in the cities of New York and things like that, we quickly figured out, well, we can't be keeping our oysters or harvesting oysters from the same place where we're dumping all our sewage. And we figured all that out, and now we are able to serve a very safe product, and I think the consumer's catching on. And we're also riding the coattails of a couple of very powerful movements right now, the sustainable seafood movement, mm-hmm. the locavore movement, and people are cherishing really the difference between different varieties of oysters and sort of comparing them like wines. I think we're really enjoying this wonderful renaissance right now.
No doubt about it. So, Bob, give us a couple of things spring to mind. First of all, when you talk about food safety, I know a lot of people think that months without an R are not safe to eat oysters in. Is that true or false? And if it's false, tell us why.
So, you know, we've pretty much conquered all of the health concerns relating to sewage. The most challenging thing for us now are these naturally occurring things, and by which I mean red tides, and a bacteria that's a naturally occurring bacteria called Vibrios. Mm-hmm. And we have not had illnesses due to red tides for decades. I mean, we've really figured out how to monitor for that, and we've, you know, sometimes people will get sick from recreationally harvested, but if it's in the commercial marketplace, I don't think we've had an illness in several years. The Vibrio bacteria is one of our last remaining challenges, and it's a naturally occurring bacteria that is most common in summer. And we are learning how to handle our product better, how to keep it iced right out of the water, how to keep it cold. And then, you know, the challenging part is teaching the consumer that, you know, if you're buying it in the fish store or in, you know, at your grocery store, you need to keep it on ice on the way home because these bacteria will grow anytime the temperature is above 50 degrees, taking what would be a perfectly safe shellfish. And if those bacteria double a few times, suddenly they might cause an illness. Mm-hmm. And the other thing we're trying to teach people about is if you're immune compromised, if you've got liver disease or certain medications that you might be on that are affecting you, or if you've got diabetes, you probably shouldn't be eating any raw foods at all, much less raw shellfish, and especially not in summer when your risk might be a little bit higher. Just cook it up, and there's many, many recipes that we would encourage you to try if you're challenged in the immune system. But by and large, most people are fine eating raw shellfish. I've done it every week for about three decades.
Yeah.
Without incident, you know.
26 years of Moonstone oysters. Yeah, I'm guessing three decades at least, right? So let me ask you, what are the biggest innovations in the industry? Because it's really changed a lot. I mean, during the course of writing that article that you participated in, I learned a lot about the history of oystering. And there was some really cool new technology and new gear. And I wondered if you could just tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So, I mean, it was only around 1950 that we learned to spawn shellfish, and that was a huge deal because it allowed us to select for certain traits and select the parents that grew fast or survived to diseases better. And that was a huge breakthrough for us, being able to rear them in the hatchery and mate different parent stock, and that allowed us to select for disease resistance because there's several diseases that will knock out oysters altogether. But through selective breeding, we've been able to select for resistance to these and greatly improved our survival. And then, you know, more recently, since I got into this business, we've had the invention of plastics, which was wonderful. Right. I mean, we used to work with chicken wire, which stands up for about a year in the marine environment before it rots and it's gone. But we have to protect our baby oysters from the crabs that just love, well, everything loves oysters, right?
Yeah.
So the crabs love them, starfish love them, and once we figured out how to make these plastic netting, it's quite durable and stands up for, you know, 5, 10, 15 years.
Wow.
That was just a huge breakthrough for us in terms of being able to grow oysters and clams. And then most recently, one more thing that we've developed is triploidy. And so while most organisms have two sets of genes, we can manipulate them and give them a third set, like we do for seedless watermelons or for limes that have no seeds. And so they don't produce eggs, and so they grow faster, which makes it easier for us to make a dollar on them, because they tend to die quickly if we can't get them to market quickly.
Mm-hmm. How long is the average? I mean, you harvest them at, what, 2 years, right?
Yeah, when I first started in this business, it would take me 3 years on average to get my oysters to market size. But through certain innovations, one that we developed called an upweller, we were able to shave a year off the production mm-hmm. cycle, and we're getting them to market on average in about 18 months now, two summers, and uh-huh. they're out the door.
How
some,
big are
some
they?
Some will take a third year, but it's great, yeah.
How big are they at 2 years? Because I know, talking to all these various different experts, yourself included, you all remarked on the fact that oysters have gone, as a trend, have gone much smaller in terms of what the consumer is looking for. And I thought that was an interesting development, that it was, like, you know, incredibly convenient for you guys who want to get them to market faster. But also, as a consumer myself, I much prefer the smaller oysters.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating. I mean, I reminisce back when I got started and made my first oyster sales up in Boston. They would have laughed me out of the place if I walked in there with an oyster less than 4 inches. And now I've got restaurants that want, you know, nothing over 3 1/4 inches, you know, 2.5 inches to 3 inches. These little things are slightly larger than a mussel, and I think I'm ripping the customer off, but, you know, I've spent time at Grand Central Station Oyster Bar in New York City there, and you'll hear someone walk in the door and say, "What's the smallest oyster you have?" Words I never dreamed I would have heard before, but, you know, this is the trend, and we are happy to provide that. It means that we can get them up, you know, in as little as a year, oftentimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, you want to, at 1 year, they tend not to have much in them, so we've learned that we can tumble them and beat them up, and they'll round up into this nice sort of half walnut shape. And that seems to be what the customer really wants, is something just slightly larger than a walnut, full of meat. And we can do that.
Amazing. Because I know I talked to Rodney Clark, and he was telling me that back in the day, I'm sure you know him up in Toronto, Rodney Clark.
Absolutely, yeah.
So he was saying that when he got into the business, because he's quite a bit older, I think, than we are, he, you know, there was the Super Fancy or something like that was 6 to 8 inches. Was the norm.
Well, and I still have a market for those. I mean, we'll have some escapees that fall off the raft, and I'll go down and dive on them and scoop them up later.
Uh-huh.
And it will be a 100-pound, 100-count, so literally each oyster is a pound bigger than my hand. And I'll get great money for them, and there's still a segment of, you know, it tends to be older gentlemen, I might say, who remember what they want. They want their money's worth.
Yeah, that would have been my grandfather. And my father. They were both from New Orleans, and they both liked their oysters really big. Can you tell me what part of the aquaculture segment is going faster? Is it oysters? Because that's what I see. But I know you were talking that clams are claiming 60% of the market, oysters 40%. So I was kind of surprised by that. Can you talk a little bit about the, you know, sort of economics of that, and why you think that you know, clams are still dominant, when I just don't see that.
Well, so it was about 15, 20 years ago that we really figured out how to grow clams, and a number of states really went into it in large fashion, including Virginia and Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, too large a fashion, and the price collapsed pretty much coast-wide from about 25 cents to about 15 to maybe 17 cents a clam. And so a number of the growers got out of it, and since then the production has remained sort of flat, and we've been seeing up on Cape Cod, where a lot of the growers in Wellfleet, Mass., there used to be about 300 clam farmers, that number's declined over the last just 5 years, almost in half.
Ooh.
In terms of the number of clams being grown out there, because they've found that they can grow oysters that are worth, you know, 60 cents.
Right.
And so they're, you know, it's not quite as much work to grow a clam. I call it benign neglect. You sort of plant them and scrub the screens every couple of months. Oysters are a full-time job tending them, but
really,
the
why
value
is that?
That
what
you receive
do you do
to... is what's driving it. And we're seeing almost all the growth on the East Coast is in oyster production.
And the clams are hard shell clams like cherry stones and quahogs and
exactly.
What else? Do they do
gooey
ducks?
They go
no
by
exotics.
Many names, but top necks, little necks, mm-hmm. cherry stones. It's all the same species. When we grow them on the farm, since the highest value is at the smallest size, we pretty much tend to get them all as little necks.
Uh-huh.
Anything that you see that's larger than a top neck in the market is probably a wild clam.
And how many, when I was talking to Perry Rosso of Matunuck Oyster Bar, he was saying that, because I asked him if he would ever start clam farming too, and he said no, because he's getting the same price for them, and also the wild clams are still so abundant. I was kind of surprised to hear that there are still so many people who are involved in actually farming clams if the wild clam supply is still quite robust.
So, and that varies highly from state to state. I mean, we... We do land about $5 million in clams in the tiny little state of Rhode Island, but
Sweet.
That's substantially down from 20 or 30 years ago when it was $15 million. So the wild stocks are, I'd say they're challenged in most areas. I mean, we are very effective predators, us humans, and they don't escape very well. I mean, they can't run away. So if you've got a lot of clams somewhere, we're going to find a way to get them out, and... I think pretty much coast-wide, the biomass of the wild clam is not what it has been historically.
Interesting. Listen, we have to take a short break, right, Joe? We have to give a little sponsor drop now, and we'll be right back. Please stay tuned with Bob Rowe of the East Coast Shellfish Growers Association for a primer on aquaculture, shellfish aquaculture, and how it's going to basically save the world. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surreyfarms.com.
And we're back. This is What Doesn't Kill You with me, your host, Katie Kiefer. On the line with me is Bob Rowe, the East Coast Shellfish Growers Association. Sorry about that. East Coast Shellfisher Growers Association, Bob Rowe. And we are talking about aquaculture primarily on the East Coast, but it's a big business on the West Coast too. And Bob, you were talking a minute ago about how it generates $5 million worth of revenue in just the state of Rhode Island. But overall, what kind of money are we talking about in terms of shellfish aquaculture? Is it, will it, do you think, become a replacement for the ailing fisheries of the Northeast, which have, you know, taken body blow after body blow over the last few years between the change in marine fisheries programs like catch shares and then the recent loss of cod. It's not looking good for the fishing population in the Northeast, and I wondered if shellfish is going to take that place. What do you think about that?
So I never like to say that we would replace wild harvest fishing, and in fact, you know, most of the stocks in the New England fisheries are well on the road to recovery. Cod has been a huge challenge, and
huge.
The quota cuts have been a huge challenge. But we had very significant issues with overcapacity that needed to be wound down, and so it's been a real challenge. We've seen a collapse of the southern New England lobster fishery, mostly because of we've seen dramatic increases in the temperature of the waters, but the lobsters have moved north, and so Maine has got so many lobsters that they collapsed their price last year. So, you know, there's changes in the environment, but we are finding a lot of fishermen who can't find jobs or make a living on the water are switching over to aquaculture. I've got a lot of people in my association who are former fishermen or who fish on the side but are now making a living growing oysters. You talk to the gear suppliers, the guys who used to sell a lot of lobster pots, they're mm-hmm. still selling a lot of lobster pots, especially after a big hurricane, but now they're making twice as much money on oyster cages.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this shift, and, you know, we, in Rhode Island, where there's 60,000 acres of water, we're only farming on 150 acres, and we're producing $3 million worth of oysters.
Wow.
So at the rate of growth that we're experiencing, I expect we'll eclipse the wild harvest of clams in about 3 more years,
mm-hmm.
and then people will stand up and take notice. But it will never replace it. There will always be that wild harvest of clams.
Well, I certainly hope so.
And we don't fight over grounds. If there's a good co-hogging spot, they don't let us lease it for oyster growth. So we're able to take non-productive areas and make them productive.
That part is very interesting to me. And also the part about the water getting too warm for the lobsters. And so I hadn't really been thinking of you in terms of lobster, but of course there are shellfish as well. And so are crabs. Do you also cover that in the East Coast Shellfish Growers Association, or is it just the bivalves?
Just the delectable bivalve morsels, the ones with two shells.
Gotcha. Okay. Are there differences in flavor between the farmed and the wild?
So if you have, if they're growing side by side, a wild oyster and a cultured oyster, you won't be able to taste the difference in the meats. There might be, you know, a different look in the shell because we handle them differently. They might come from a different genetic stock, but the fact of the matter is that they are what they eat, and they're eating the local plankton. And mm-hmm. while my farm was, you know, a mile or two away from Perry Rasso's, and we could taste the difference in each other's oysters,
yeah.
it was pretty subtle. And an oyster, you know, a wild oyster grown in the same water as a cultured oyster, the taste will be... You won't be able to differentiate between the tastes. Now, different species, absolutely. I was growing the European flat oyster for a while, and that tasted markedly different than the American oyster.
Yeah, because on the East Coast, it's only Crassostrea virginicus, I understand, except for those few guys who wanted to do the flat oyster.
Right, and it was the challenge getting permits, but a few of us have tried. They're not the easiest to grow. I mean... The challenge is always to do it and make money at it. There's a number of species that we can grow that we can't either ship, or they don't have enough value to justify the labor that goes into it. Like a soft shell clam up here, we call them steamers.
Yeah,
it's just a low value product. We can grow them. We just can't make money at it.
Right.
I used to grow the bay scallop, and they were great product, but they had a shelf life of about 3 days, which was not very helpful.
Right, so that means you can only go into local restaurants with it, because it's got to go right from the boat to the restaurant, right?
So, you know, and then there's things like the razor clam. We can grow them, but they get up and they swim away. so that's a challenge.
Uh-huh. You can't put netting over them to make them stay in place?
We're working on it. The uh-huh. challenges have not yet been surmounted. How's that?
Okay, I get that. You make me ask, I was going to ask what other species, but you've kind of answered that. So scallops, not so great because they don't last very long. Razor clams, they swim away. What other species are there? There's like geoduck clams, for instance, I know, are grown out on the West Coast. Manila clams are grown out on the West Coast. Are we just not, our water isn't cold enough, or we don't have the right plankton conditions? Why don't we grow that here?
Well, you know, I think the geoduck clam, which if your listeners haven't seen one of these monstrosities, they grow to like 5 pounds. These clams are like a steamer on steroids.
Yeah.
They're really quite prodigious. But
I like that word. They are disgusting.
It's an exotic species here, so we would not be able to get permits to grow a non-native clam like the
uh-huh.
Manila. And the geoduck. The Manila was actually introduced unintentionally with some oyster seed that they were bringing over from Japan when they were getting started using the Japanese oyster on the West Coast.
Right.
We also do well on the East Coast with mussels, and while it's taken the U.S. a little bit longer to get into this, up in Canada, Atlantic Canada, and on the West Coast as well, it's a multi-million-dollar industry, and we're trying to get this started on the East Coast here in New England, because we know that U.S. imports a tremendous amount of the blue mussel.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And they're relatively easy to grow, but we're challenged getting permits, and lots of people don't want to see somebody farming in their viewscape. So,
mussels you can grow on long lines.
Exactly.
So you're doing, some people are doing that like out in Narragansett Bay, but when you and I spoke a few months ago about this, you were telling me that there are a couple of pilot projects for growing, you know, enormous amounts of mussels, but in federal waters, and that somehow, who controls that and who permits that, those federal waters is still kind of ambiguous. Can you talk a little bit about that whole permitting process? Because I think that's kind of an interesting issue. I mean, who's, you know, the state controls coastal waters off, 2 or 3 miles off the coast of any given state?
Right. It's out to 3 miles of state waters, and then it becomes federal waters.
Uh-huh.
So even in Rhode Island, we've got a little strip of federal waters between us and Block Island. And every state has, you know, sovereign rights to control what goes on in their tidal waters, and each state handles it quite differently. But once you get out into federal waters, there's no established leasing authority. So we're very reluctant to go out there because we don't have a legal authority to say we own this crop, or we're, mm-hmm. you know, the best we can do is get permission from the Army Corps to put a structure out there, which would be sort of like an oil drilling platform or something. But in this case, it's a mussel farm. You have
right.
to get a permit anytime you're going into navigable waters to make sure you're not in somebody's way.
Mm-hmm.
But several efforts at legislation have failed because the idea of aquaculture got quite contentious a few years back when people were concerned about potential impacts from fish farms.
Right. And there are no impacts from shellfish farming because they're filtering the water. They're not adding, you're not feeding them. You're not, they're not producing huge amounts of waste, et cetera, et cetera.
Of a good thing can become a bad thing. And there are a few isolated cases around the planet where you put in too many shellfish in a limited space, especially if there's not adequate currents. And, they start competing for food, and the growth rate slows down, and you start to see impacts. But, you know, by and large, you really have to work hard to exceed what we call the carrying capacity of a marine system. We had a scientist come and evaluate that because it was a concern. You know, we're seeing
sure.
this rapid growth in production. How much can we do before we start to hit these limits?
Uh-huh.
Well, it turns out that it's about, you know, you can cover about 50% of most bodies of water with oyster farms and before you start to worry about that. So that was quite a relief. We'll never get there because people are too attached to sailboats and water skis and things like that. But, you know, if we can grow $3 million worth of oysters on 150 acres, we really don't need too much area to have quite an impact and provide a lot of jobs and a lot of wonderful products. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that we have to sort of wrap it up here, but I think one of the things that struck me when we were talking earlier was the fact that this kind of aquaculture, because it has such a low environmental impact, really is kind of the wave of the future in terms of meeting the protein needs of our ever-growing population. And if predictions are to be believed and we'll be at 9 billion in, 2050, then the growth of shellfish aquaculture is going to be kind of crucial to our survival. Would you concur with that?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it's great because it's one of the most sustainable forms of food production on the planet. No impacts, no drugs, no chemicals, no
right.
fertilizers. And it tastes great, too. So.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to argue with an oyster or a clam. If you love the bivalve, then you love the bivalve. And as you said, they can be cooked into any number of recipes as well. So it's not just that you have to eat them on the half shell. You can eat them in any number of ways that make a lot of sense. So, Bob, sadly, even though I had a billion other questions, particularly about the research that you're carrying on, maybe you'll come back and talk to us about that a little bit. I just want to mention that you're doing nutrient credit trading as a means to limit coastal eutrophication. I thought that was really interesting because it parallels cap and trade to a certain extent, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, there were throughout the course of this conversation, I've been struck by the parallels between either sort of big industry, you know, like the kind of manufacturing industry that produces carbon problems, but also the meat industry, where you have sort of the whole issue of like how many things can be crammed into one small space and still survive, and the, you know, the issues with waste disposal, et cetera. I mean, there's a lot of, and also fish farming, which we really barely talked about, and I would love to talk more about with you. But we're going to have to wrap it up. And why don't you tell people where they can learn more about the East Coast Shellfish Growers Association and some of the research that you're doing, because I think it's a really interesting field.
Well, you know, we've got a great website, ecsga.org, East Coast Shellfish Growers Association, and, you know, we're trying to show people how there are tangible environmental benefits associated with shellfish culture. We can be a part of the solution for habitat and for nutrients and for water quality. And I just, you know, it's a great product and a great story to tell, and I really appreciate you having me on, and I'll be back in a heartbeat. You just have to ask.
Oh, that'd be great, Bob. I'd love to have you back, because I really think this is a very interesting part of our, you know, food solutions for the future, and you're a wonderful exponent for your industry. So thank you again so much for joining me today on Father's Day. Thank you to my sponsor, Sam Edwards, a great father himself and one of the ultimate cure masters, and thanks to my engineer. And remember, folks, pledge your support to Heritage Radio Network so you can continue to hear from people like Bob Rowe. All you have to do is go to the website and press the button, and we'll take your money happily, and you can become a member of our family. So until next week, thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio, or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.